From 90.7 WFAE, this is a special edition of Charlotte Talks, a public conversation, unrest in the Queen City 1 year later. I'm Mike Collins. We're coming to you from Spirit Square's McGlohan Theater in downtown Charlotte. At this time, a year ago tonight, September 20th, 2016, just hours after the shooting by police of Keith Lamont Scott, a group of demonstrators began to gather at Old Concord Road in the University City area. By the next night, those protests would filter into downtown Charlotte, building in intensity, eventually becoming a riot, or as some prefer to call it, resistance. Whatever you call it, the response to the shooting put Charlotte in a national spotlight in a way it had never been before and shook the city to its core. It started conversations in every nook and cranny of our town, indeed across the state, that continue today and which will certainly continue over the next 2 hours. We all have a stake in where these conversations take us, and that is why this program is being broadcast statewide. In addition to Charlotte and Hickory, we're joined by listeners from Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Fayetteville, and points in between, thanks to our friends at WUNC. The purpose of this special two-hour Charlotte Talks is not to rehash the events of last year, but to look more closely at what has come from the shooting and the disturbances and soul-searching that followed, as well as what is left to do. However, before we do that, a brief reminder of what brought us here tonight.
This has been a difficult couple of days for the city of Charlotte.
Don't let them break the windows. Come on out the car. Keith, don't do it. Keith, get out the car. Keith, don't you do it. Don't you do it. Keith, don't you do it. Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him? Did you shoot him?
Handcuff.
Legacy gripping his hand.
I'm not going to come near you. I'm going to record, though. I'm not coming near you. I'm going to record, though. He better be alive because I'm coming.
Roughly 1,000 protesters marched through portions of the university area last night and early this morning in response to a police shooting death of an African-American man. The victim is 43-year-old Keith Lamont Scott.
Shahida Whiteside, a student at Central Piedmont Community College, says she came out to join the protest and is frustrated.
I can't watch another black man getting shot on another Facebook page, another newscast. I can't keep watching it happen. And then nobody else is doing nothing about it.
And just as the 11 o'clock freight train passed, protesters began throwing rocks and water bottles at police and smashing in the windows of police cruisers, some so badly they had to be towed from the scene. And then, all at once, police in riot gear donned gas masks and helmets and began shooting rounds of tear gas into the crowd.
About 100 people stood in silent protest in front of Bank of America headquarters at the end of the workday. Signs read, "Legalize being black," "Stop killing my brothers," and "Black Lives Matter." As the crowd grew, people began chanting.
Being black is not a crime. Being black is not a crime. Being black is not a crime.
Then they marched, first to police headquarters for more chanting, and then to Marshall Park, where a larger and more disorganized protest gathered.
There were hundreds of protesters on the street last night. Originally, it was about the police shooting death of a 43-year-old African-American named Keith Lamont Scott. But the anger over Scott's death was quickly overtaken when word of last night's shooting spread from person to person. They again blamed the police.
They want to hurt us. Y'all got all that money.
The situation escalated. More riot police were called in, banging their batons against their shields as they walked in line before stopping at an intersection, where protesters met them, yelling just inches from the officers' faces. The police stood silently for a time, then threw concussion grenades and tear gas canisters. A steady breeze carried the gas throughout the crowd. The protesters retreated down the street, regrouped, and went back again and again.
Here comes round three of tear gas. The crowd is now throwing them back.
The Charlotte-Mecklenburg police officer who shot and killed an African-American man in September will not face any charges. Mecklenburg County's DA said today all the evidence supports Officer Brentley Vincent's claim that he felt threatened.
In the days that followed Mr. Scott's death, we watched as long simmering frustrations boiled over. I heard observers say, "This is not Charlotte. This is not the city that we love." But it is. This is Charlotte. This is where our friends, families, neighbors, and colleagues felt so passionate that they marched on our streets to call for change. But the fact that criminal charges are not appropriate under the law in this particular case does not mean we can dismiss the concerns expressed by those who raise their voices to raise the consciousness of this community. I think it's high time that all of us recognize that this is Charlotte, and not everyone experiences the same Charlotte.
That last voice was that of Mecklenburg County District Attorney Andrew Murray, stating something that might not have been obvious to much of the city a year ago. The fact that not everyone experiences the same Charlotte is a realization that emerged from last year's disturbances and served as a wake-up call to work toward change. So tonight, we examine three key areas: economic opportunity and how it impacted the unrest, as well as what is being done to address economic disparities; activism, not just during the disturbance, but in the days and months afterward. Was this the catalyst for people to engage with others in the city to make improvements? And, of course, policing, which here and around the country has been undergoing scrutiny. What is being done to build trust, and will reforms work for both police and the citizenry? And that is where we start. We're joined by Vicki Foster, Assistant Chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. Thank you for being here tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Robert Dawkins is the State Organizer for Safe Coalition NC. That's a nonprofit founded in 2013 to promote police accountability. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
And because the events of last year did not spring out of nowhere, because they have deep-seated roots, we'll be hearing throughout the program from Brenda Tindall. She is the staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Vicki, let me start with you, Vicki Foster. Due to the rash of violence, or the rash of videos, I should say, that are usually taken by camera phones and by bystanders to these incidents involving police, the nation at large has been exposed over time to the confrontations between police and usually black men. And we're seeing something that the black community has known about for a very long time, which came as news to many people who are not in that community. And, of course, the Scott shooting followed on the heels of many of those incidents last year that were on television. So how would you assess your department's interactions with the African-American community in our city then and now?
Well, I think, you know, after the riots, we took a look at what we've always known is that there's still distrust within the Afro-American community. And so what we learned was that it was a little deeper than what we thought. And our focus since then has been on continuing to build relationships in our Afro-American communities. And so we've done a lot of different things, and some of those things have worked really well. And some of those things we're continuing to improve. You know, one of the things that we did right after the riots were we started construction conversation teams. What we learned was that people wanted to be heard, and people were not being heard at that particular time. And we learned that that was one of the key elements, is that people want to be heard. They want to be able to express their feelings. And so these teams now, if we have an incident, we have 40-plus officers trained that actually deploy to the actual incident. And they are the ones that talk to citizens and try to tell them, you know, okay, what's going on, and try to let citizens understand exactly what's going on. Because at that particular time, they're not able to get the answers that they want.
So we've had two black police chiefs. You're an assistant police chief. You're right. Also African-American. Mm-hmm. When things like this happen, when you see these shootings on television, mm-hmm. and you're at the head of your own departments, mm-hmm. what do you think? What goes through your mind?
Well, you know, for me, and I can only speak on myself, I mean, anytime I see a officer-involved shooting, whether it's CMPD or across the country, I mean, obviously I'm disheartened. I do think that there are shootings that have really, really caused some serious problems in our community because there were not what people would consider to be justice. And so I will say that every time I see that, I'm concerned, depending on the circumstances of that actual particular shooting. You know, I have questions just as well as anybody else. You know, I'm still human. Even though I'm a police officer, I'm still human. So I'm always disheartened by officer-involved shootings.
If there has been anything good that has come out of this shooting and the, all of the other shootings, it is that there is a raised public awareness about things that have been well known in the African-American community. And Robert Dawkins, one of those things is profiling. A lot of African-Americans allege that they're pulled over by police or followed through department stores by security guards because of the color of their skin. And your organization, Safe Coalition NC, has been working on what you working on ending what you call discriminatory profiling. How prevalent would you say that has been in Charlotte and throughout North Carolina?
It's been prevalent since 1865 in every city and every state of the country. What we found from, what Charlotte found from Keith Lamont Scott's What African Americans Has Known for Years, that there is a basis for us to say that there is mistrust with us from the police department. I mean, this goes back from, you know, slavery and slave catchers to peonage to all of the other things that the police department and the sheriff's department were the legalized people to round up African Americans and to punish African Americans. And I think that the police department is making an attempt to fix that history, but every time more incidents like this happens, it pulls that Band-Aid off again.
But you work around the state, if I understand this correctly. You work around the state. So are there areas of the state that are more receptive to seeing this as a problem that has been ongoing and want to work to fix it? Are there areas of the state reluctant to do that?
So there are cities in the state that may pay more attention and may pay more lip service to it, like a Asheville, a Chapel Hill, a Durham. But at the same time, they pay more attention to it. They speak more about it. And within the same month, somebody that's African-American will still be beat, arrested, or shot by police. So I don't think that that's helped fix the problem either.
Some say this stems from racism. Some say it stems from fear. Perhaps it stems from both. There seems to be a fear in the some of the people in the public of African-American men in particular, particularly at night and in certain situations. Brenda, you were at the Levee Museum of the New South. You've done lots of exhibits on this. You've done more programs probably than we have on this issue. Where does this suspicion of African-Americans and this fear of African-American men come from historically?
Historically, I think to your point that it's really deeply embedded in the history of slavery, and I would argue that you know, the 13th Amendment in particular, which was meant to provide the constitutional teeth for the dismantling of the institution of slavery. The 13th Amendment actually has a loophole that criminalizes black men in particular. And so when we talk about the ways in which that suspicion is sort of nurtured, I mean, it's in our legislation. It is in our social mores. It is in it's in the ground.
So most of us
don't, an invention of the contemporary period, right?
I would wager that most of us don't know that about the Constitution. So if we don't know it, how is it that we have it in our genes?
I don't know that I'm suggesting that it's in our genes. What I'm suggesting is that the laws often inform the social realities.
Is there any empirical evidence, historically speaking, that justifies this fear?
Absolutely not.
I knew you would say that. But I wanted to ask the question. Kerr Putney, CMPD Chief Kerr Putney, promised to take steps to ease the tensions that we saw last year with these protests and riots. The city hired an organization called the Police Foundation, a group out of Washington, to study the department. Their report has yet to be released, I'm told. Putney says that CMPD has changed nonetheless. Critics say reforms haven't happened. So while we've been waiting for this Police Foundation report, what has CMPD done, Vicki Foster, to improve things?
So, you know, as I started talking about just the construction teams, you know, we did transparency workshops. What we found is that a lot of people felt during the riots that we weren't being transparent. They felt that we were not telling everything. And so we started doing transparency workshops, which are for our citizens. It is an abbreviated Citizens Academy where they can come out and learn why we do what we do, learn about our policies, learn about our procedures, so they can understand sometimes, not always, because no matter what, people are not going to always understand why we do what we do. But we did do those workshops, and we are continuing to do those. We've had over 100 citizens to go through those. We implemented de-escalation training, which we have always done de-escalation training. It was within other areas of our training. We now have a specific block that is 2 hours that all officers have gone through for de-escalation training. On top of, you know, the chief does so many community forums. He's out in the community as often as he possibly can, and they're very open and candid forums, if you've ever attended, where he gives people the opportunity to ask what they want to ask.
Is it making a difference, do you think?
I think he's making a big difference, because whenever you are able to ask the leader of an organization whatever you want to ask and you get an answer, I absolutely think he's making a difference.
Go ahead, Robert. Did you want to jump in there?
And I do think the chief has done wonderful with things with having these transparency workshops. But you have workshops, you talk about transparency, but transparency, you've got to be either totally transparent or you're not going to be transparent at all, and there's no middle ground. So at the same time that you have transparency workshops, you have in January the shooting of Josue Diaz, and the police department doesn't want to release that video. And they say they don't want to release the video because the officer was undercover. Well, you could block out the officer's face and still show the video. Then last week, when Citizens Review Board made recommendations, we didn't get all of the recommendations. We only got part recommendations. Mm-hmm. So transparency has to be 360. It can't be half of that, or you'll never build public trust.
One of the things that you mentioned a second ago was that you want people to understand how the police works and why they do the things they do. And one of the big questions a lot of people have is, why do police have to resort, more times than not, it seems, to the use of deadly force? We have tasers and things like that. And many times this deadly force is used against minorities, not just black people, but other minorities. It seems that way to outsiders. From your point of view, is that what it is?
Well, what I can tell you is, when you say use more times than not, we have over 600,000 contacts, close contacts, with citizens every day. So regardless, one officer-involved shooting is too many. But when you say more often than not, that's a little misleading, because we work 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, with contacts with citizens all day.
So it's what we see on television.
It's what you see. And it's the ones that are the most important. I mean, someone losing their life is the most important. That's the most important piece. But to say that is it's a little misleading, because we have 600,000 contacts with citizens a year. So that's a little misleading.
Okay. Robert? Yeah.
And again, I agree with Assistant Chief, but like Citizens Review Board, we can't just talk about officer-involved shootings. There's cases that either just go to the sergeant level, which are smaller infractions, to larger cases that get heard by command staff, to cases that make it to internal affairs. So the whole experience of being disenfranchised and profiled isn't just a police shooting. It's also a traffic stop. It's also being at the bus terminal, and the transit police treat people a different way. It's going into neighborhoods that they don't believe that you should be in, and having a stop that you can't justify, even though now we're doing articulable reasons for traffic stops. There's still that as a thing. So I don't want it all to be confined to the two or three police shootings. This is an encompassing problem that African Americans and Latinos and LGBTQ people go through daily.
Which raises the temperature of any contact with police, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm. Your organization worked on reforms in 2012 on the Citizen Review Board, and those reforms led to, I'm told, more cases, including the Scott case, to be granted fact-finding hearings. But in all the years of its existence, the Citizen Review Board has never sided against the police. And in the most recent situation with the Scott shooting, the review board took the side of Chief Putney, saying that the officer involved had the right to do what he did. He was following policy. He was within policy of doing what he did. But they did that on a 4-4 split decision. That's because the entire complement of the board wasn't there for, I think, slightly specious reasons. So given their record, has the board always sided with police because police have always been right and done the right thing, or is there a fundamental problem with the Citizen Review Board?
There's a fundamental problem with the Citizens Review Board. First problem with the Citizens Review Board is it's not an independent police board. It's a board that you are making, that is hearing, following up on an internal affairs investigation. And basically what you're trying to do is poke holes in the internal affairs in violation, the internal affairs decision. It has no power to go in and independently investigate its own cases. It has no subpoena power to subpoena witnesses to come before it. And, of course, it's an advisory board, so it can't make any decisions to terminate or discipline an officer.
Hmm. How does the police review the police advisory board, the citizen review board?
How does police view the citizens
review board?
I mean, I don't know that I can answer how police view the Citizens Review Board. I mean,
they've never sided against you, so I mean.
Well, it's not about whether they side against us or whether they, you know, side, you know, for us or against us. I mean, we are appreciative of the fact that there is an independent group that takes a look at the investigation. I mean, the people that are on that board are not people that we selected. It's not people we put on the board. So, you know, even though people don't want to say it's an independent board, we don't have, you know, connections. We didn't have anything to do with the people that are on there. And I will say this. I do think that from the Civil Service Board to the Citizens Review Board, I do think you have to look at anybody's motive that wants to be on any board, and whether that is pro-police and whether that is against police officers. So I do think that that's one of the things that needs to be looked at. And there's not really many qualifications to be on the board.
Will we ever hear the full recommendations that they put out following the Keith Scott shooting? Will we ever see those recommendations?
I mean, I can't answer that because I'm not the chief of police. Okay. But I will tell you that, you know, being transparent is what he does. So I can't tell you what will actually be released.
I have a minute left in this segment, and transparency is one of the big things to come out of this shooting of last year. And right. There's a new law on the books that prevents police from releasing the videos from body and dash cams and even security cameras. Not even elected officials can see them.
Correct.
Without the permission of a judge.
Correct.
Is that a wise law, given the political tenor and the frustration seething throughout the community?
Well, I'm not going to say that it's a wise law. I mean, because the people that need to see it immediately, such as the family, the people that are involved, they do have the ability to petition to see it. You know, whether it's right for it to have to go to a judge to be released, I don't know. But what I will tell you is that if you leave that in the hands of individual police chiefs, and then you will have a difference in who releases what and who doesn't. So I think that there had to be some type of law with some type of requirements as to when and how you release a video. So I do agree that you had to have some type of rules as to when you can.
You have 10 seconds.
That's not exactly how the law is worded. The law is worded that the police chief gets to make a decision if your image is captured in the video to release the video. Within 36 hours, if you do not grant it, then you can ask a judge to have the video released.
It's Robert Dawkins with Safe Coalition North Carolina, Vicki Foster, Assistant Chief of CMPD. They will return later in the program, as will Brenda Tindall, a staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. When we come back, activists and the role they played in responding to the shooting of Keith Scott a year ago today, and the role they've attempted to play in changing the status quo since that day. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE, as well as North Carolina public radio stations across the state, thanks to WUNC. I'm Mike Collins, and this is a special public conversation from Spirit Square's McGlohan Theater, Unrest in the Queen City 1 year later, focusing on where we're headed due to the events of 1 year ago today. We've spoken about policing. Now we turn to activism. The Keith Scott shooting was a kind of wake-up call for many, including the realization that we are living in two Charlottes. Hundreds filled the streets during last year's protests, and we hear now from two activists working for change to find out how they turned anger into action and to get their thoughts on what, if anything, has changed. Greg Jackson is the founder of Heal Charlotte, who was at the protests and has since created an after-school camp for at-risk youth. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Ash Williams is a community organizer with Charlotte Uprising, a coalition of community organizers. It's an organization that came together after last year's disturbances. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And remaining on the panel from the last segment to provide some historical context where necessary is Brenda Tindall, staff historian from the Levine Museum of the New South. Ash. Okay. Ash, in the opening of tonight's program, I mentioned that some prefer to call last year's riots resistance, and you are one of those people that prefers that. So can't resistance turn into the kind of violence that erupted last year on the streets of Charlotte?
I actually don't think so, Mike. I would say that the kind of structural oppression that folks of color and directly impacted folks, I would say that what we deal with is actually violent. I would say that what happened to Keith Lamont Scott was violent, and then what happened to Justin Carr was violent. And the way that we responded was by using resistance. And for us, we didn't want to castigate anyone who chose to, again, respond or react to that structural racism or that structural oppression in any particular way. And so we hold that all resistance is righteous, and we actually encourage folks to show up in the way that they think is necessary.
You, Greg, spent a year in prison in New York for drug dealing, so you've been on both sides of this equation. You have firsthand knowledge of dealing with law enforcement, but if I understand your story correctly, you weren't involved in protests prior to the Keith Scott shooting. What made that the catalyst for the beginning of your activism?
Well, I think it's obvious why it went down at a protest. It was random shootings, one after another. I was a rapper before I was protesting. I made a song that was about Trayvon Martin, Philando Castile. You know, I made a song about that. So it was deep, it rooted in my heart. And I was serious about that. But after I was done protesting, I wasn't going to just keep protesting. I was going to get active. I was going to get out my chair. And I was going to do something. I'm not going to keep pointing fingers at people. And I ain't did nothing yet. So I started pointing the finger at myself. Like, what can I do in my community so I can fix something?
Is it true that that idea, the spark of that idea at least, came from Detective Gary McFadden? You were on the steps of police headquarters last year, yelling at the police.
We were having a peaceful protest. I felt like we needed to go to the headquarters because that's where I knew the police stayed. My grandmother's, God rest her soul, she was a Black Panther. My mom raised me right. I know where they at. So I led 200 people down to the police headquarters, and I felt like we needed to get somebody outside. We needed to get somebody to come down the steps. I wanted to scream at the wall of their home. And Mr. McFadden came downstairs and he asked me three questions. He said, have you seen justice? I told him no. He said, do you know what it looks like? I told him no. He said, do you know how to get it? I told him no. After those three questions he asked me, I start shutting up. Because at some point, you got to say, what have I done to get some justice?
How would you answer those three questions, Ash?
I would say that I haven't seen any justice. What was the second one, Greg?
Have you seen justice?
I would say I haven't seen any.
Do you know how to get justice?
I would say I know how to get justice. And I would say that Charlotte Uprising has demonstrated that, or tried to provide folks with a political option. And that option looks like a couple different things, Mike. It looks like political education. So we've actually invited folks and invited them to try to talk to them about what abolition looks like and what it looks like to imagine a community, imagine a Charlotte that doesn't include police and prisons. We've invited folks to come and reimagine what safety looks like that doesn't include police and prisons. We've invited folks to come and learn about what direct action is and how expansive it can be. And while it does look like protests, it also looks like call-ins. It also looks like petitioning. It also looks like voting. It also looks like demonstrating. Giving people a lot of options is something that we believe we've done.
You just used the word abolition in a different way than most people have heard it used in the past. What do you mean when you say abolition?
When I say abolition, I mean critically, a practice of critically interrogating surveillance, prisons, and the ways in which we're all made to be subjects. So for us, that looks like bailing people out of jail, which some of us are doing right now. For us, that also looks like talking to folks about how and why we believe this system has failed us. I use Ruben Galindo as an example. Rest in power. He called the Spanish language 911 for help, and he didn't receive help. And that was an option provided to him by the system. But I would argue that it was those folks who facilitated his death. The police shot him after they arrived, after he asked for help. And so we think that folks need to stop calling the police, and we're excited about teaching folks what that might look like.
We're going to hear a lot of new ideas from Ash in this segment of the program. I've read a lot of what you've written and had said about this in the past, and a lot of them struck me as very fresh and very new, but maybe they're not. Do they have antecedents in history?
I would argue that they do. Earlier, you invoked the Panthers, for instance. It's no surprise that folks are mobilizing around issues related to police force, as well as what I'm thinking specifically is about the militarization of police and the use of excessive force. That has often been the germ of urban unrest historically. I mean, one might only look at Watts. One might look at New Jersey, Newark, excuse me. One might look at Charlotte. One could look at St. Louis to suggest that there has been a historical trajectory of communities responding to perceived violence.
Well, let's talk about that, because the Trump administration has just renewed a program that the Obama administration stopped, and that is allowing police departments around the country to purchase military equipment, the kind that you would see in a war zone. And many departments have bought it in the past. They continue to buy it today. They will do it now that Trump has lifted the ban. But the police department here has said they're not interested in that. Is that a good sign?
That's because they still have most of the equipment that they got during the DNC. So one of the demands that Charlotte Uprising made 365 days ago was that that equipment, that was the extra kind of militarized equipment that they received for the DNC, actually be returned, and that they wouldn't use that anymore. And that's one of the demands that still hasn't been met.
So when people in the community see these vehicles and these weapons and the kinds of equipment that they're allowed to buy now and use on the streets of American cities, is this seen as protecting citizens or attacking citizens? Is it an affront or is it a comfort? Or does it depend on which community you live in?
First of all, I'm going to ask you, are we here to talk about activism and what is going to change us? Or are we going to talk about complaining and complaining and complaining? When are we going to address some action? When are we going to address what are you going to do? I'm not going to sit up here and point fingers and complain. I work with a group of organizations that work hard. And we've been working hard every day since the protests and the riots. We done trained 40 to 80 officers. We have 50 kids in a youth camp where I live at. I feed these kids. I have 8 coaches that are my friends. We step up and we work. We meet people halfway. I'm not here to talk about Donald Trump. He don't live in this city. I'm here to talk about the city of Charlotte.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the things that you have done, because your group has, as you said, worked with police in a really unique way, actually. You have done these, I guess, for lack of a better term, seminars.
Yes, I have.
Where you go in with a group of guys.
It's called the Constructive Conversational Team that Assistant Chief Vicky Foster was talking about. After the protests and the riots, Captain Mike Capagna, he was promoted to major, and he was in charge of 4 divisions of recruitment and training. I wasn't playing when I said I wanted to meet with him the next day. I went and met with him the next day. I was in his office the next day. I said, we need to work the next day. And then we worked. We came up with some ways so we can go train some officers and let them feel some real stuff so they're not scared when we out here protesting. So they're not looking at us like we animals when we protesting. Now there's a team that gets deployed, and they go out. And last time, the Latino man got shot. His name escaped me because I'm passionate right now. They sent out these officers. And these officers called my phone directly. I got business cards, Greg. I don't have tickets. I got business cards. And you know what? I'm going to get coffee. And you know what I did? I emailed them to make sure they went and got coffee. Because that's what it's about right now.
So you work with you in these seminars, you've worked with these officers, and you get up in their face and you challenge them as a protester would challenge them on the street. And you say that some of them, most of them pass, some of them don't. What's their reaction? What do they take away from that experience?
It depends.
How does that help?
It depends. Some officers are robotic, and they give you facts. I listened to T.D. Jakes. He said there's 3 listeners. There's active listeners, there's prospective listeners, and there's factual listeners. We need a lot of prospective listeners out here, because officers, they hear you scream, and they give you facts. And we mad. We active listeners. I don't want you to give me a fact. I got some answers. I want to answer. I want to answer. Mm. But the answer ain't in the protest. The awareness is in the protest. The action is what you do after the protest. You got to stand up and do something in your community. Now, what works in my community don't work in everybody else's community. But my community, I knew it was a need for these kids that's running around vandalizing and don't have anything to do from 3:30 to 6:30. They don't have nobody in the neighborhood to look out for them.
I know you take a different approach. Your organization, ASH, takes a different approach. So how do you, when you hear him
talk? Hold on, before you even go there, because I only got a little while, right? So I'm going to get this out. All right? I know you want to keep talking and talking, but this right here is what I got a problem with. Everybody coming together after 1 year, and y'all been absent. Somebody told me stay woke. Listen, brother, I'm not talking everybody, but somebody told me stay woke. I've been woke. I'm so woke I can't go to sleep. So stay woke. When you leave here, go to healcharlotte.org and sign up. I got so many programs for everybody to sign up to. If everybody did a little, nobody would have to do a lot. And as soon as you are aware, you are immediately responsible for doing something.
So what's your reaction to that, Ash? I know that your group takes a different approach, but what's your reaction to what he's saying? Because what he's saying is everybody is part of the solution to this.
Yeah. I would say that cops aren't a part of the solution to this. I would, if I was
not
trying,
a part of the solution.
They are not a part of the solution to this. So I would describe the current kind of institution of policing as a dead tree. And when I hear that, when I hear about folks saying we need more cops who can speak Spanish, we need more cops who can get trans folks' pronouns right as they're taking them to jail and incarcerating them. And we need cops to be more trained and better trained at de-escalation. What I hear people saying is that they want to trim the branches on the tree that's already dead. I hear people saying they want to mow the lawn under a tree that's already dying. What I'm asking and what Charlotte Uprising is trying to demonstrate is the uprooting of this tree for something else to grow.
You're nodding in agreement, and I'm surprised at that. You're nodding in agreement.
Nah, I'm not here to dispute everything. Like, that's cool. You know, I'm for the community, man. I think we need more community organizers. I think we need Spanish organizers. If you go to my neighborhood of Orchard Trace, if something happens, I took a conflict resolution, that mediation training, right, from the CRC. So if you come to my neighborhood and there's a problem, my property manager calls me. She says, Greg, I got a minute problem that might get bigger. I need help. I'm there 24/7. This community activism thing, it ain't a three-hour job. It's all day. It's 24/7. And no, I don't get paid to do this. This is my passion. I love my people. And not just my black people. I love my people. My hood is different. I got 40% Mexican, South American, 10% African, 50% black. We have culture days. We have fun. I invite the CMPD to my neighborhood. I tell them, come through. Get out your car. Come meet my kids. Come meet my people. Come out and come see us. Because that's the only way they gonna know who you are.
So given what he just said, and given what you said a moment ago about chopping down the tree, essentially dispensing with law enforcement, that seems unrealistic to me. But in case you were successful at that, what then?
I imagine a Charlotte where people are excited about protecting and serving one another. I imagine a Charlotte where folks have the skills to solve the kind of disputes maybe that your apartment, your rental agency was talking about. I imagine more situations where folks have power with each other and shared power and not power over each other.
And as an activist organization, what do you do or what are you doing to accomplish that?
But one of the things that we do is hold police accountable. We use a variety of tactics for that. Direct action, call-ins. We also train people who are not familiar with direct action. Another thing that we do is actually that political education around this dead tree that I'm talking about. So more folks would be in line with abolition if they knew more about the history of policing as stated during the previous panel. And so what we try to do is orient folks towards safety, and we try to orient folks towards justice without having to rely on police.
So Brenda, Ash has said elsewhere that modern policing in the U.S. originated from patrols, otherwise known as enforcers of the law, intended to hunt and corral escaped slaves or lawbreakers or black people or the property of whites, and that policing remains a system that entrusts these same patrols to treat black and brown people as prey, not as human beings. Are those, in fact, the roots of modern policing?
I would argue that is an accurate account of the ways in which black and brown people, and particularly people that have been marginalized historically, how they've been subjected to, how they've been criminalized, one, and thus become prey, if you will, of patrol, of policing. So I would argue that's a pretty accurate articulation of that history. The maturation of that is what's really sad, is as we're moving further and further away from so-called institution of slavery, what we still see is the criminalization of people of color. In the 21st century.
So since it's highly unlikely that law enforcement is going to be abolished in our lifetime or any lifetime for that matter, wouldn't the key be to do what he's talking about, and that is get the police officers to come to the neighborhood, get out of their cars, get to know the people in the neighborhood so that the badge is not an impediment to getting to know people? You're saying, though, Ash, that building trust, and I'm going to quote here, building trust, we are limiting the conversation, right?
Yeah.
How so?
I think because we're not considering what safety looks like for those who are most directly impacted by police violence. We still live in a Charlotte where police kill people without recourse. They killed Ruben Galindo 2 weeks ago. So when folks are asking about what has changed, we can see that nothing has changed. And so what I'm urging us to do is to be open to critically interrogating the histories and traditions that led us to what happened 365 days ago. And so if we are being critical about that, then we're going to open our minds to other strategies for what safety can look like.
Lost your train of thought?
Yeah.
I've been there.
Yeah.
you got started as an activist a year ago tonight.
Yep.
So in the year that you've been doing this, and I'm sure it didn't happen overnight, it took you a while to find your way through this process.
Of course.
What changes have you seen? Are you optimistic? Are you happy that you got involved in this? Can you point to something that you say, that was bad, now it's better?
I've always been optimistic. I was a rapper and from the neighborhood. I've always been optimistic. You got to be optimistic to be an artist, first of all right? So I've seen personal change. Because I stepped up to make a personal change. You're not going to see change if you ain't try to sow a seed nowhere. You're not going to see change if you ain't try to make no change. And it's all about building trust. All my resources, all my relationships come from building trust. That's why I'm cool with the Michael Smilenbergers of the world. That's why I'm cool with the Michael Duvalls of the YMCA. And they sent 21 of my kids from my neighborhood to Camp Thunderbird for free. It's $1,000 a week. Now, you think that would have happened if I sat on my hands and ain't do nothing? No, it wouldn't have happened. Now, these kids is looking at something that they ain't never seen before. Now, their eyes is open to something they ain't even. I ain't here to tell you about the past. I'm here to tell you about the future. And it looked good.
So in the 45 seconds that I...
If you came on this side of the fence, it looked good.
In the 30 seconds that I have left.
So
now,
I got 30 seconds.
No. In the 30 seconds I have left, Ash, can you point to something that is better today or something you've made progress at?
I've seen individuals be transformed in service to this work. And so I actually invite you to be transformed in service to this work with us. I've seen organizers who may have just learned how to turn out a group of folks go from doing that to bailing hundreds of people out of jail, mobilizing thousands of peers, but also keeping people in the loop. So I am excited about continuing to do that work.
Ash Williams with Charlotte Uprising, Greg Jackson, founder of Heal Charlotte. They will return later in the program with Brenda Tindall from the Levine Museum of the New South. And after this short break, we examine an issue that has received a lot of attention in the last year. Economic opportunity, or the lack of it in some areas and within certain segments of our population, and the role that played in the undercurrent of frustration which fueled last year's protests. We'll continue in a moment from the Glowin' Theater. This is Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks from WFAE and on stations throughout the state, thanks to WUNC. This is a special two-hour public conversation, Unrest in the Queen City, 1 year later. We have an audience, as you can hear, gathered here at Spirit Square's McGlowin Theater, and we will have them join this conversation in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn our attention to a national issue that certainly played a role in last year's unrest in Charlotte, and one that is a significant challenge statewide. Economic opportunity. Prior to the shooting of Keith Scott, economic opportunity was a focus for local leaders after a report revealed Mecklenburg County ranks near the bottom in the country for a lack of upward mobility. If you are born poor in Charlotte, chances are you will die poor here. It became quickly apparent that that black mark on this shining city of the New South was a factor in the anger and frustration which was readily apparent among those in our streets during the protests. So, what's been done to rectify that? Let's hear from some of those working on changing the economic equation. Dr. Patrick Graham is president and CEO of Charlotte Works. It's a workforce board serving this region of the state. They place over 7,000 individuals with barriers to employment in jobs. Thank you for being here. Nicholas Wharton is Chief Programs and Partnership Officer with the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. He's also a WFAE board member. Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And Patrick Mumford is Director of Economic Development for the City of Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
Let me start with you, Pat, because a lot of middle class and wealthy individuals have had their lives enhanced by being the beneficiaries of an economic inheritance. But there is a flip side to this that a lot of people don't think about and certainly don't understand, and that is the inheritance of intergenerational poverty, which possibly has an even greater impact on people in a negative way than inheritance does. How many people in our city are recipients of the inheritance of intergenerational poverty?
I do not know a number, but I can tell you there are large areas of the city that run from the west to the north to the east, where there are communities that have unemployment rates that are 15 percentage points higher than the average in this community. And you raised a good point that these are really systemic issues, and there's a lot of correlation to education, to housing, geography where people have lived, investment in those communities, and this has been going on a long time.
So if it's impossible to get out of poverty in Charlotte, and apparently that study is correct, it is, why is it so hard?
So what the study said is that it is next to impossible, not impossible, to move from the very lowest rung to the highest rung. I think what I took from that is that while that would be great, I think the more challenge is how do people just move up a couple of rungs? So go from poverty to where they can be self-sustaining. What is the reason for that? There are numerous reasons. I mentioned education. There's an incarceration rate that's a challenge for people when they come out. People have multiple barriers, and the two gentlemen on their side of me can speak much more intelligently to this, but have multiple barriers to employment. So when we have an economy that's thriving right now and people are looking to hire folks, they can choose people that don't have those challenges. So they are passed over in an inequitable way.
So I want to spend just a little more time with you on this, because this Keith Scott shooting, really, when I say it shook Charlotte to the core, I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think people were really taken aback by what happened and by what they saw in the streets, and not the destruction of property, but just the anger and the frustration. And several years ago, way before the shooting of Keith Scott, way before those riots last year, we discovered that we were very low in Charlotte on social capital, that people of different races did not meet really at all outside the workplace. This year we ranked 50th out of 50 cities for social mobility. We have long struggled in Charlotte with the dearth of affordable housing. We need to break up pockets of poverty. Our schools will be reorganizing next year to do that, or try to do that, because that's detrimental to successful learning. We've known this. This didn't happen overnight. These economic disparities have been around forever. So if we didn't do anything about those things before, or if progress toward fixing them has been slow, has it picked up now in light of what happened last year?
I would suggest certainly from a city standpoint and a public policy standpoint, there's been a really large focus on this issue. Have we moved the needle dramatically? No, but think about generational issues aren't going to be resolved in a year. But we've put together, with partnerships of both Urban League and Charlotte Works and others, the city is working to offer opportunity for people. Greg mentioned this in the last session, that if a child is in poverty and is not exposed to a work opportunity, how on earth are we going to expect them to go out and find a job? They don't even know what it means to show up on time, potentially, or how to shake somebody's hand to get an interview. And so it begins with small things and getting people opportunities to understand what it means to be employed. And then there's a continuum to go all the way through to full-time employment and sustainable.
Nicholas Wharton's with the Urban League of the Central Carolinas, and I'd like you to describe for people who live in Ballantyne and other affluent areas of our city what kind of poverty we face in certain parts of Charlotte that led people who live there to believe that they have no future and that they have no stake in this city.
Wow, what a question. Let me start by sort of contextualizing how I see the problem, okay? Charlotte is 17th largest city, right, in the country. We have 10% of the state's population. We have about 30% of the gross domestic product of the state. But yet, we have close to 25% of the population that earns over $100,000, right? And we have essentially two economies. One economy that is thriving, in one even smaller economy that is in gated communities that are living well, sort of insulated from the kind of conversation we're having now, right? And then there's another population that is completely locked out of opportunities. The mobility study was clear. If you grew up in one of those five zip codes, the opportunity for you to move up is absolutely nil. Now, when I think about the circumstance we find ourselves in now, I understand we're here talking about the violence, the unrest that occurred. But there's a level of economic violence that's going on, right? That is slowly draining the life of a significant portion of the community. At the Urban League, we see that population as human capital, individuals to invest in, right? We're in a sort of mutual relationship, right? It's a collaborative relationship. Charlotte's a fabulous place for many, but it is really a dead end.
That's the two Charlottes that we heard about at the beginning of the program. So what does poverty look like for these people? What is it like for them?
Sure. Well, I think when you think about, just I give you one example. Last week, I was at the men's shelter. It's about 75 men there in their brokenness, right? They had chronic unemployment. They had families, many of which had disowned them. Many had addiction problems. Some had mental health issues. Many, though, wanted to have a good and full life. But their lives had passed them by because opportunities they were closed from. Like poor education, lived in communities that were conflicted by poverty and crime. But yet, they wanted to have a better life, but didn't have a road to make it. And these were men. 75 men, and I spoke to them about the opportunities at the Urban League and how a job, being able to feed your family, being able to earn a salary. Our motto at the League is education, placement, and training equals dignity. It's about a job. It's about jobs.
Right. This economic disparity that came to light a year or so ago in Charlotte came as a surprise to a lot of people. It did not come as a surprise to Patrick Graham, one of our guests here from Charlotte Works. And I want to ask you about how you were so prescient about this in a moment. But we have to break for station identification. You're listening to a special two-hour edition of Charlotte Talks, a public conversation, unrest in the Queen City 1 year later, on 90.7 WFAE Charlotte and 90.3 WFHE Hickory. And we're being broadcast statewide on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC-FM HD1 Chapel Hill, WFSS Fayetteville, WRQM Rocky Mount, WUND-FM Manteo, WBUX Buxton, and WUNW-FM Welcome. We are examining three areas that emerged as key due to last year's shootings a year ago today, and to the disturbances that rocked Charlotte in the aftermath. We've spoken about policing and police relations with the community then and now, the role of activism in both protests and in helping to improve conditions and awareness in the Queen City of societal problems. And now we're talking about something that has become a nationwide concern, one throughout the state, and which has given the city in particular a black eye, the difficulty faced by many in moving up the economic ladder. So Dr. Patrick Graham, President and CEO of Charlotte Works, you are also the former CEO of the Urban League, and you wrote a book and you launched the State of Ethnic Charlotte Initiative, which predicted our area's gap in income mobility years before that current study that came out that we've been talking about. What made you so prescient, and what did you predict?
Well, one of the things that we looked at right away was that the economic downturn that we were experiencing affected African-American communities disproportionately, as many things do. And so when this economy caught a cold, the African-American community caught pneumonia. And so in many respects, what you see is that you lost half of your black wealth during that period. Half. And that was due to vulnerability of that wealth. But I also say this, if you look at this map, you all can't see it. Right?
It's
you
radio.
Can't see this. Very little. But what I want to show you is that some of the things that both Pat and Nick are talking about, right, and we talk about the economic violence, has happened a lot in Charlotte through gentrification, displacement. And when you look at this map, right, these are the highest pockets of unemployment. And they have now escaped out of the center of the city due to gentrification and have been spread throughout Charlotte. This brings all kind of infrastructure issues, educational issues for these people, right? And it also puts an additional stress. And when Pat was talking about some 15%, some of these pockets are up to 30% unemployment. Mm-hmm. You got to think about that. And so how do you expect these people to thrive in a community where you have the cost of living constantly increasing? So I really summarize this in two ways. And I'm going to give you two quotes. I'm going to read them, if you don't mind, really quick. The grievance in their minds is the animus, the anger. And we're talking about protesters. Mm. They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not. I mean, yes, it is a welfare state. We have spent trillions of dollars on welfare, and we've put people in bondage so they can't be all they are capable of being. The Honorable Congressman Robert Pittenger. What are we talking about here? We're talking about meritocracy. We're talking about reinforcement of racial hierarchy. But most important, we're talking about those who deserve mm-hmm. and those who don't. Yeah. And in his mind, during that statement, and that is something that we see throughout many pockets in Charlotte, mm-hmm. that there are those who deserve opportunity and those who don't. Right. Well, let me give you just one more quote. I actually talked to six individuals at our career centers, and I asked them to come up with a vision statement. And we talked about the many issues that they were facing. And so I helped them craft this. And so this is in response to the Pittenger quote. It says this: we don't want to die for neighborhoods we rent, but live for communities we build and own.
Wow.
That's powerful. Mm. So you can see the difference in between those two. And the reality is, Michael, that we are right now in another reconstruction of a newer South. Mm-hmm. And that reconstruction is very similar to what it was before. We are, the past reconstruction was one in which you also had, right, a renewing of our economy. So you got to think about, we now have a renewing of our economy. But it was also one in which we had social disparity and actually even violence to control people and prohibit them from having the benefits of that economy. Now, I'm not saying that police and others do this intentionally. But what I am saying is, if we look over that economic violence that Nicholas referred to, and as an urban leaguer myself and still an urban leaguer, I understand the language, because the reality is that we have an opportunity, and we have more than just an opportunity. We have to have will to actually create opportunities for these people and not have this type of thought. It's part of who we are.
Well, you use the word violence in relation to the police, and it's not just police that violence is, as we've learned earlier in this program, it's not just police committing violence on people at the lower ends of the economic spectrum, and also African Americans in general because of the color of their skin or whatever. It's the lack of opportunity, and it's the lack of educational opportunities. And God knows we've been trying to do this in the public schools, but not too much success in some circles. They would say that not too much success. The Opportunity Task Force, which was a 19-member council, studied issues of economic mobility here in Charlotte, and they identified what they described as three highly interrelated determinants most likely to have the greatest influence on the trajectory of opportunity. They are early care and education, college and career readiness, and child and family stability. What are your organizations doing in those three areas to make a difference?
So let me respond to that, but I want to catch up on something my colleague Patrick said about the quote that was so offensive, right? And I realize that the congressman has apologized over and over again for that, and I'm sure some people will certainly accept that apology. But what I want to say, though, what I really want to say about that is that the way that was framed, right, it also sort of presented a sort of existential threat in that. I've been in part of lots of conversations, many of us have, on economic mobility, roundtable conversations, and invariably the conversation comes to, if I give up something, right, if someone else gets something, I lose something. Sort of a zero-sum game,
But I thought a rising tide raised all boats.
Well, you know, that's hope, wishful thinking, right? But that comment spoke to that in a very subtle way. Now, in terms of what we're doing at the Urban League, we have a sort of menu of very high-demand workforce development programs. Heating and ventilation, fiber optics technology, highway construction, high-voltage wire line workers. All these are jobs that you only need a high school diploma, right, to train for. 4 weeks to 3 month training. And these individuals come through these programs, right, and we have about an 80% job placement rate. So at the height of all the unrest, the city, Pat Mumford's office, along with Goodwill and the Urban League, partnered up, mm-hmm. right, to focus on hiring and training in those designated communities. And I'm happy to say that over this 18-month program, but we've trained about almost 140 people at about 60 to 70% job placement rate, right? So we've been focusing on making a difference.
And Charlotte Works has placed about 7,000 people in jobs, and I've forgotten the exact figure. I'm trying to find it in my notes, but I can't. It's in the millions of dollars in terms of money in salary paid to these folks. How have you done it, and what are the barriers to employment that are faced by so many people who can't get ahead?
Good question. Well, one of the things that we did is that we've developed more of an individualized training program. And so that means instead of having individuals, say, forced into a program, you're literally scholarshipping the individual to a training. Right. So we work with those individuals doing case management and career advising and actually direct them based off of their interest as well as capabilities to those industries. And we actually look, believe it or not, as industry and employers as our primary customer. And then match those people who are struggling with employment, right, with the skill sets needed there. And so the number you're trying to think of is that last year we placed 7,065 individuals with barriers to employment. They earned $103 million in salaries. Right. And what that means is that, number one, we know that people are capable, right? But, two, I want to go back to something else really quick, too, and the notion that we can provide opportunities for people with just high school diplomas is a great one. But I will say this, too. Let's not overemphasize college is not for everyone only when we're talking about poor and people of color. Right. Because here are some other realities. Information technology, which has over 72,000 jobs, right, in North Carolina. 72,000. 89% require a bachelor's. Energy, the program that Nick is talking about, was heavily involved with that. But I will tell you, out of the 2,000-plus jobs in that sector, in 82,000 in the U.S., 64% require a bachelor's. So my point here is that we often say college is not for everyone, but we overemphasize right. that in communities of color.
So given what he just said,
good point.
Given what he just said, Pat, and given that the city has decided to focus in the aftermath of what happened last year on three things, people, places, and business, it is businesses who hire people, and businesses right. need to see a result from the people that they hire. So how do you convince a business to take a shot, to give somebody their shot, to quote Hamilton?
Yeah, so that's really a subject that gets to the mindset of our community and this collective ownership of this challenge. So the way I look at it, when you look at all the cranes on the skyline, you think, gosh, this community is doing really well. Everybody must be prospering. As we know, that's not the case. So how do these businesses that come to Charlotte, because it is a great place to be, how do they come here and own some of this? How do they connect with these two gentlemen and say, we're willing to be a part of the solution and hire some of these people, help point us in the direction of these qualified individuals that you have trained? And that's important for us to move this forward.
We're going to take another short break here, and when we come back, we're going to include the public in our public conversation, unrest in the Queen City a year later. We have people gathered here in our auditorium at Spirit Square, which we'll hear from next when we come back. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE, as well as stations throughout North Carolina, thanks to our friends at WUNC. I'm Mike Collins. During the last hour or so of this special conversation, public conversation, unrest in the Queen City 1 year later, we focused on three areas that emerged as key ingredients in what led to the shooting a year ago of Keith Lamont Scott and the protests and riots which followed and which gave Charlotte some unusual, unwelcomed national attention. We've spoken about the role of policing and police relations with the community, with Vicki Foster, assistant chief at CMPD, and Robert Dawkins, state organizer of Safe Coalition NC, which promotes police accountability. We met two of the many activists who play a role in the protests and in mobilizing others since that time to push for change. Greg Jackson is the founder of Heal Charlotte. Ash Williams is a community organizer with the Charlotte Uprising, who had to leave us for another event this evening. And we've talked about the role played in all of this by a lack of upward mobility or economic opportunity. We just heard from three people working to improve that deficit in Charlotte: Patrick Mumford, Director of Economic Development for the City of Charlotte, Nicholas Wharton with the Urban League of the Central Carolinas, and Dr. Patrick Graham, President and CEO of Charlotte Works. And throughout the evening, we've called on Brenda Tindall, the staff historian at the Levine Museum of the New South, to provide some historical background. We brought all of our panelists back to the stage here at the McGlowan Theater, and now we want to hear from you, the public, in this public conversation. We have an auditorium full of people, and if you raise your hand, we will bring a microphone to you. Just as a reminder, we ask you to keep your questions and comments as brief as possible so that we can hear from as many people as possible in the time we have remaining to us. And let's begin right here. Hi.
Good evening, Dr. Yvette Miller. So I do want to thank everyone for sharing your opinions with us, and I'm sure we've all been informed, you know, exactly what your opinion is. So one thing I have to ask you to do is to please stop using terms like a black mark, and anytime an event or has something negative associated with it, please stop using terms like that. Because we're black and there's certainly nothing wrong with us, so please stop using that. So my next question is, and anybody can answer this question, gentrification is a code word for moving black folks out so white folks can move in. So please explain to me where that term came from, because it's just an interesting word that has been created in the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. That means exactly what I said. So please explain what that really means to a community, what gentrification really means to a community.
Well, for the definition of the word, Brenda, I'm going to you.
Is my mic on? I think that it's important to understand the arc that gentrification belongs to. So thinking about urban renewal is really important. Redlining, which predates urban renewal, but for this community, I think it's really important to draw those clear connections between urban renewal that occurred here in Charlotte in the 1960s with federal funding, $40 million of federal funding to actually essentially change the landscape of communities that had been targeted as blighted communities. For this community, a place like Old Brooklyn, which was located in the Second Ward part of Center City, was the site of thousands of people and families. It was a mixed income community. Some folks typically think about black communities as being socioeconomically monolithic. That is not the case for a place like Brooklyn. What you had were over 200 businesses that were owned and operated by African Americans in that community, and over 1,000 people were actually displaced as a result of urban renewal.
But why do we call it gentrification instead of urban renewal?
Well, I think that as time has progressed, the language has changed. And so we go from talking about renewal to talking about revitalization. In terms of the actual definition of gentrification, you're right to note that it has sardonically been used as a term for Negro removal, is a concept that urban renewal has been tied to. And in the case of gentrification, it indeed has a very similar connotation.
So let's get to the key part of her question, which is what happens to a community when gentrification occurs? And I want to misquote you. That is what you asked. Pat Mumford, we've talked many times on this program, and the city has done a lot of studies on this and a lot of work on this, and that is the lack of affordable housing, the lack of workforce housing. And as gentrification occurs, we have even less of it, and it appears that there are not many tools in the governmental toolkit that you have at your disposal to stop it, or am I wrong?
I would say you're correct. There aren't tools to stop it. What we have to do is try to get ahead of where gentrification will occur, and it's no longer a government-sanctioned tool like in the 60s. It's more of a market-based. So values in these inner-city neighborhoods are seen as really the place to be, and so market pressures begin to escalate the cost of those properties, and I think it really hits strongly the people that rent. So if you think about some of these inner-city neighborhoods that have become the place to be, you've had renters that have lived through the crime, lived through bullets in their windows and their porch for 20 years. Now, all of a sudden, it's changed over, and they can't benefit from this new prosperity.
But it's also happening to areas that are not crime-ridden. They're just lower-income areas that people have spent their lives living in, and if they're displaced, they've got no place to go.
So that's where I'm going. If we can get out in front of that and supply some housing for people to stay in the areas where they have their support networks. The other piece is we talk about these statistics, and these are people. These aren't just numbers. And so we could say, well, a house, they vacated here, and there's a house on this side of town, but that's not near their family, that's not near their job, that's not near their school, that's not near their doctor. So we have to try to figure out where there are options within that proximity of their support network. But gentrification does benefit people if you've lived there a long time and you do want to sell and your value has increased. That's great. We're seeing more of the challenges, those that don't have that.
Can I also add that affordable housing, the affordable housing conundrum in Charlotte impacts more than just low-income people. To be clear, if you actually spend more than 30% of your earned income on rent, you are rent burdened, and there are a lot of people in this city who technically would qualify as middle income, who cannot afford to stay in rental communities in this city. And so when we talk about the affordable housing conundrum, it's not just limited to people who qualify as lower income. It also impacts folks that belong to middle income.
But it is, a recent study showed that it is more of a problem at the lower end of that scale. Patrick Graham.
It is, and part of that map I showed you actually is the result of gentrification. Earlier, and how you've got now higher unemployment rates dispersed in the second and third tiers of the city outside the ring. But I'll say this, too. I think there are other things that we can try differently. So, for example, we have some affordable housing dollars. We actually do invest sometimes in building complexes. You know, so we've got Renaissance West, others, which are great examples. However, they still cluster people. So one of the things that I think that we can do is take existing stock with those dollars in those neighborhoods that we know are going to turn, and we can actually purchase those with the same dollars we're using to build others.
You're talking about land trusts now or something different?
That's right, and you can buy those, but not only that. We are often subsidizing rent, but we're still paying a landlord's mortgage. Why is it that we can't take those same subsidies and subsidize mortgages over longer terms? Mm-hmm. And longer periods of time that will help people be able to deal with some of the tax increase and others that come with the new value, but also be able to train them to now be able to use their newfound wealth in those homes. We can take existing stock, and the reason I say take existing stock, because it also helps with the segregation issue that you see in the economic mobility study.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over here.
Good response. Oh, wow. I wanted to, one, commend everyone for being on the panel today. Great discussion. I would like to address what I deem a silent killer in both affluent as well as impoverished communities, apathy. What I'm actually witnessing and working with various nonprofit communities is, on one end, they don't know that they're impoverished and they don't know that of intergenerational poverty. On the other end, we see a large group of people that say that there's not an issue or why don't you work harder? And this was a perfect segment because our hot button topic has always been this political process, affordable housing. I would like to hear from the panel more about affordable living, because if you can't afford to live, and me working with certain individuals who are making $8, $9 an hour, who are coming from, I haven't worked before, but I'm making minimum wage or less than what I can to live, and I have 2 and 3 kids. I think it's important for us to open up that dialogue to address affordable living, not just affordable housing. Thank you.
Go ahead.
So the first thing I will say to that, and I'll let other people make their comment, is that we need for, even though it's great to have businesses, you know, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, all of the people that formed this opportunity task force say, we're going to get together and we're going to come up with a ways to handle affordable housing, and we're still waiting for what they're going to do. Well, the first thing they could do is pay a living wage. So I get tired of people coming to the table saying we're going to look for solutions when there's a solution on the table. And if you are a company in Charlotte and you're still paying people $8, $9, $10 an hour, but you're talking about you want to fix affordable housing, you need to fix your house before you start helping us fix others.
That's Robert Dawkins with Safe Coalition NC. We're going over here.
So my question was, so the school that I go to is predominantly Black, and the one thing that I see a lot is we call ISS, we call it the institution. And so whenever somebody gets put in ISS, we'll be like, oh, yeah, that's the institution life or whatever.
I have to stop you just to ask you what ISS is so we can go forward.
In school suspension, sorry.
Okay, thank you.
And
I've been out of school a while. So.
Right. Like, I used to say that too, but then I just started thinking, where did that really come from? So that's my first question. Where did that word institutionalized come from, and how does it relate to the Black community? That was my first question. And my second question is also, like, at school, kind of the norm of being Black is you have to be hard or whatever, and you have to listen to rap and all this stuff. And I'm there for like 8 hours a day. And so half of the day, I'm asleep.
So you're talking about the pressure to conform?
Yeah, and my mom tells me you don't have to be that person, but it's just kind of like I'm there most of my waking hours.
So.
Oh my goodness.
That, I got to tell you, that's a great question, and many of us have lived through that in our lives. But what about that? What about the pressure to be something other than what you're not, and the pressure that particularly young Black men may feel about having to be tough?
Come to my camp. Come to my camp where you can live and be free, brother. You don't have to be what they tell you you gotta be.
Greg, how do they get to your camp?
My camp is at 325 Orchard Trace Lane in Orchard Trace, right behind Hidden Valley. We're part of that corridor. Y'all go to hillcharlotte.org. Y'all stop past, see my property manager, Miss Regina, who's a beautiful woman, and y'all just come past.
So how do you convince somebody that they have the courage to be who they are and not what they're supposed to be?
It's all about uplifting. It's all about understanding what they're going through and really and truly understanding what they're going through, not being afraid to have. We have a circle of trust at my camp. We have this every day. These kids come and tell me everything. They let me know what's on their mind, and we build this magical word, trust, with each other and a bond with each other. And then it comes out, and then when they meet me halfway, it is my job to make sure it happens and that they get opportunities, and I use my resources. The best resource, y'all, is being resourceful.
Greg Jackson, let's go to Nicholas Wharton. I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, I wanted to say something to this young man. What is your name? Caleb?
Caleb.
Well, Caleb, let me just say this to you. You know, for you to have the confidence
to get up and talk,
and ask that question was really very, very impressive.
Amen.
And I want to thank Mom too for the work that you're pouring into this young man.
Amen.
I'm just so impressed. We're all impressed. But Caleb, to the second part of your question about how do you stand up and be who you want to be, right? You're already doing it, number one. You have to keep doing what you're doing. You obviously feel very good about who you are and whose you are. And I know that's a part of the equation. I can see the training here, right? So you got to be real positive about being who you are, not just a black boy, but a young man growing.
Mm.
So your future is bright, and you got a long way to go, young man.
Amen.
So don't worry about being square. Keep working hard in math, right? Keep reading, right? Keep doing those things. The more they call you square, the better off you'll be.
Mm-hmm.
Can I also ask,
Eddie doesn't have a mic. Can you give him the microphone for just a second? Oh, you don't have the microphone? Do they call you square, or is he putting words in your mouth?
Square, but okay. The main thing that I get is, because I'm gonna be honest, I'm 11. I have not hit puberty yet, so my voice has not deepened yet. My voice hasn't deepened yet, so I still have a high voice. So
it's okay. Puberty's not all it's cracked up to be.
Because
oh man, that's so funny.
I've got a feeling that pretty soon they're gonna be.
Where are we going next? Up here. Okay.
Too funny.
Mm-hmm. Can I add something to the inquiry that this young man asked? I think first of all, clearly you're very brilliant, and it's really inspiring to see you have that confidence to stand up in this forum and offer the kinds of questions that you provided. So thank you. I think it's really important to make sure that our schools have teachers that have cultural competence. And teachers who have the wherewithal to promote or to ensure that there's never a poverty of imagination about who you can be and what kinds of learning can take place in that space. Yes. I also think teachers set the tone in terms of how people are perceived. And so when we talk about this idea of sort of the incarceration state, or when we talk about this idea of the sort of preschool to prison pipeline, the germ of that is often in our schools. So when we see young people inordinately being, basically criminalized in some ways, and or met with punitive actions that aren't justified, we have to really think about how our schools become sites of that kind of criminalization processes. So we need to make sure that the kinds of teachers that have proximity to young people have cultural competence and are informed on the issues that impact the students that are in their schools.
So let's go to the back of the house and hear from you.
My name is Gwen Harris, and Caleb actually got the topic going on what my question is. We brought up the topic of children born into poverty and generational poverty, and we talked about getting adults out of poverty and getting them work. So how do we invest in our children, and I mean the really young children, like elementary school age, to teach them things like financial literacy, self-control, self-confidence, how to be a professional and things like that at a young age so that it is instilled in them and become a part of who they are at the core, so then when they grow up, they're not trying to learn these things as adults. And their parents, obviously, if it's generational, their parents don't have it to teach them. So how do we instill this into our systems, in our school systems, in our preschools, so that these children are getting this at a young age?
You want to take that one?
Yeah, I think okay. One of the things that we do as a workforce board, for example, is that we do what we call certified career pathways. And that is for the state, we actually take industry, higher ed, community colleges, and K-12 systems, and we look at sectors and literally develop the curriculum that one needs to go through, all the way from kindergarten straight into the job that's needed to accomplish that. And part of that also is what we call soft skills development. And so we have a curriculum that's been adopted by the community college system called Working Smart, and we actually developed that right here in Charlotte. With partners. And what that does is it teaches people, number one, how to be on time, how to deal with conflict resolution, how to deal with diversity. And then we also partner with others to talk about things like financial literacy and others. I think the main thing that we have to do as advocates is really talk to the state itself about making sure that these are part of the curriculum across the board. And that you don't have some schools where you'll have it and others where you won't. I mean, the reality is it has to be integrated and woven into the fabric. And I will also say, too, for those who are part of industry here, we need you to get more engaged
yes.
in curriculum development as well as more engaged with young people at a very early stage. Because at the end of the day, you're going to help provide either the job opportunity or the entrepreneurial opportunity they need.
Let me, before we go to the next question in our audience, let me share with you some questions and comments that have come in on Facebook while we've been talking. Courtney on Facebook says, very important reframing by Nick, and by Nick, I guess she means you, Nicholas Wharton, regarding economic violence. You can't talk about social justice without economic justice. Neither can thrive without the other. And Robert on Facebook says, nothing has changed since this time last year. Black people still, all caps, haven't replaced white supremacy with justice. The white supremacists haven't stopped practicing white supremacy. Gentrification is still happening. Let's go over here.
Okay. Hi, my name is Alicia. I was born and raised in Charlotte and currently organized here. Greg, earlier I heard you mention being the child of a Panther. And so one of the things I've heard from former Black Panthers is that one of the things they learned is that they could never out-firepower the firepower of the United States government. And so my question around land, housing, and financial resources and wealth is that what can we do in Charlotte so that Black folks and poor folks aren't spending our lives trying to play catch-up? And there is no program or initiative targeting white folks and wealthy folks and asking them how they can mitigate some of their wealth or shift some of their wealth and resources to those poor folks and Black folks outside of the realm and the life of philanthropy. So I'm asking you, I've heard a lot of talk about Black folks and poor folks getting jobs, doing better, going to programs, after school programs, all of that. But what are the programs and initiatives targeting white folks and wealthy folks to shift their resources to our folks?
I do know they have a RMJJ. I attended RMJJ's Dismantling Racism workshop. And that opened up a lot of my friends' eyes as far as like a councilwoman at large, Julie Isold, Molly Barker from Red Boot. These women, I needed help. to get these 21 kids to Camp Thunderbird, right? So the last thing you think is this neighborhood that I live in is going to get help from Myers Park. That's not going to happen. There's no way in the world, right? Julie Eisel pulled up from Myers Park with her truck full of donations, full. Nobody had to pay for nothing. But that didn't happen. It wouldn't have happened if I didn't step up and challenge somebody. I had to say, all right, it's just ball in your court. And if you don't move, then we got a problem. And if you care about your reputation, you gonna move. And I put people in a corner, and I make people move. And people move, and you find out when you're doing some good work out of good faith, it's some good people that step up and make a move, and they are great human beings. But you got to give somebody a chance first. You got to jump up and move first, because all this complaining and you ain't busting a move, ain't nobody going to meet you halfway. Nobody's going to meet you halfway. And I'm telling you, when I thought it was all about somebody's reputation, and I realized that they didn't even care about that, they said, don't post me. Don't put me out there. I don't, and I'm sorry, Julie, for saying your name, but you helped me out a lot, boo-boo. And that's somebody, and I want to tell everybody, we're doing a lot of complaining, right? 8% of this city voted. 8% of this, come on. Come on. And to your person that's online that said nothing's changed, a lot has changed. We have 64 murders, homicides right now. Anybody got a problem with that? I got a problem with that. That is too much. That is too much. So let's address these issues and let's attend to these issues because they real. Stuff has changed. But we got to address them and stop complaining all the time and make a move. Yeah. Or if you up, lift somebody up. I'm going to challenge you, and I'm going to say it. The ones that I know that got some white privilege, use it for me because I don't got it.
For those people listening in other parts of the state, the 8% turnout at the election he's referring to is our recent mayoral primary here in Charlotte.
Right.
Let's go over here.
I am totally, I can understand the underlying themes of, that we're talking about here, the economic inequities and everything like that. I sure have tried to do a lot of work to address those issues over the past 12 months. But let's not forget why we're here, and that is because of the death of Keith Lamont Scott. I and other people showed up at the crime scene as the investigation was completing, and we listened to the community of Keith Lamont Scott, the neighbors, the family members, the friends, and they demanded accountability from the government for executing a man without due process. That is, they knew that it had to happen right there and then, because what has happened since has been predictable. We knew he would not be charged through the criminal justice system, Officer Brentley Vincent. We knew he would not get discipline from CMPD, because policy shows that you can execute a man on fear. The government has created laws and policy to protect them to do that. Assistant Chief Foster, I've known you since you wore a blue shirt. I saw you out that night. And as the people were demanding those demands, expressing their First Amendment rights against this, what we considered an unnecessary death by the government, you told me that this wasn't the way to do it, to demand change. Now, this death of this man at the hands of the government has really changed our city over the past year. It's part of every conversation, and you guys have made changes, but no policy has changed. That I am the son of a New York City fireman. And after 9/11, after 343 of my father's brothers died, they were men running in and women running into fires the next day. And they could not do that because they were afraid or they were fearful. The only arm of the government that I know that can act on emotion is the police department. We have communications teams, which I think all officers should be excel at communication in the first place. We have transparency courses. But why has no policy changed, making it okay to deny the due process of an American based on an emotion? And are you okay, because policy and the criminal justice system has said that this killing is okay, are you okay with training your officers to dealing with a situation like this in the future? If you aren't okay with that, why hasn't the policy changed? And if you are okay with it, how can you expect certain communities to build that genuine trust over time?
Vicki Foster is the assistant chief at CMPD. Vicki?
So let me address, because you had a couple of questions, so I'll start off with this. Policy changes have not occurred, but what I will tell you is this, and a lot of people don't understand the policy, and we've had these conversations, as you know, and when we have a imminent threat, unfortunately, you know what policy says. And right, exactly. And so where I can't talk to what that officer felt that day, so I'm not going to try the case right here. I can't speak to, you know, what he felt. But what I can speak to is this. What I'm not okay with is we are concerned about when officers encounter people. What we're not concerned about is why the encounter occurs. And what I will tell you is that the majority of our calls for service are in our Afro-American communities. The majority of our calls for service is when we deal with a situation where there's an officer-involved shooting, there is a gun. What we do want people to do is to listen and put the gun down. But let me just say this. That doesn't mean that everything's going to turn out okay. I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, every step is followed and everything turns out okay. But what I will tell you is we also have to have some accountability, police and citizens, in what we do and how we respond to things. And so I will tell you, I'm not okay with any officer-involved shooting, but I want the same passion for the 64 homicide victims that we have. People don't show up for those 64 people that are killed with the same passion and the same vigor that we have today. And what I will say to that, no, and I understand your frustration, but what I will tell you is we have to care about every victim the same way we care about one victim. And so until we all come together and care about every single victim and what happens to them, when people say, you know, well, don't call the police and we want to trim dead trees and all this great stuff, well, the stump is going to still be there. We're going to still be there, because if people could resolve their differences, then we wouldn't have a job. So unfortunately, when people resolve their differences, that's what happens. And so what I will tell you is that we would love, you know, to be put out of business. We would love to be put out of business, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen. So the ideas of some people is great. You know, you can trim trees, you can cut bushes, you can do whatever you want to do. But the reality of it is we will still be here, and we're here for a purpose. Now, I will be the first to say that, you know, there are state laws. There might be many things that need to be looked at. But what I will not do is put myself up here to say that officer at that particular time, I don't know what he felt. So I'm not going to speak on that. So, you know, I'm not going to speak on what he felt and how he felt, because until you're in that situation, we can Monday morning quarterback all day long. So again, what I will tell you is, yes, there are changes that probably can be made in laws, but that is not coming from CMPD. So if you want to act, you want to be an activist, you want to then petition the right people about laws if you feel that those laws are not appropriate.
Robert Dawkins, you want to jump in here, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Assistant Chief Foster made some good points, but I think what Braxton and what the community is saying is, yeah, there's 64 murders, and if there is a murder in Charlotte and it's not caused by the police, you're on a wanted poster, you're on homicide, you're on first 48. When you're caught, you're going to get punished. We have not seen an officer yet get punished for LaRico Williams, Jonathan Farrell, Janisha Funville, Jose Diaz, Mr. Musawik, and the public is going to say, and if an officer is involved in it, then I do understand that everybody has a right to protect themselves. But each one of these has not always been, when you look at stuff, for protection. If you have a gun in your hand, you have a gun in your hand. If the gun's not pointed at you, then now we're going to talk about split-second decisions. It takes a split second to take someone's life the same way it takes a split second to defend your own. And I hope that people won't be as subjective on this, and that police officers will have some type of training, something better, that so many people aren't getting killed. And it does seem, from looking at it, you have a higher incident, you have a higher chance of getting killed if you're a black person, armed or unarmed, by the police in an encounter than you do if you're white. And I think that's what Braxton was getting to.
Okay. I know you want to follow up, but I also, and you feel free to do so, but I also want to ask you about this. Chief Putney has said that when someone has a weapon, de-escalation is moot. If they can get the weapon away, then they can talk. But what's the rule if somebody has a weapon and they won't put it down, but they haven't discharged the weapon, but the police fire on them? What's the rule there? How is that call made?
Okay, so let me tell you two things. There is no rule, but the one thing I do want to follow up on is what Chief Putney said, and that is the piece that is very key. It is very key to understand that people say, well, why come you just, who can you just talk to them, and why can you do this, and how come you couldn't use a taser or a less than lethal option? Mm-hmm. Because when someone has an object in their hand that is deadly, then you meet with the same force. Now, what I would tell you is de-escalation is for after the gun is dropped. It's for after that. And this whole notion of, okay, well, the gun is down, and, you know, everybody wants to say, oh, well, the gun is down and the gun is not pointed at you and so forth. I won't get into reaction times because, you know, that's part of one of the recommendations from one of the studies is to be able to show a validation study about how long it does take from a gun to go from here to here. So I'm not going to get into that whole piece. But what I will tell you is that our encounters of people with guns that will not put them down, I would tell you this. If I tell you to put down a gun 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times and you do not, as a common person, take the police officer out, I don't think at that point that you mean me any good. So you can say, you know, however you want to say, but if I tell you to put a gun down that you're holding at your hand and you do not listen, I'm not going to think that we're now going to sing together. Okay, so at that point, I am not going to be comfortable that you mean me any good. And so I can't, again, so I will tell you, there is no rule about, you know, what to do if the person's gun is down beside them. There is no rule about that.
Well, let me ask you this.
Sure.
If you're on the other side of that, you're the perpetrator with the gun, not even a perpetrator. You're just a person with a gun, and that's you've been asked to put the gun down, and you don't put the gun down. Right. There must be a reason I'm not putting the gun down. So how do we get to the core of that reason so that they eventually will put the gun down?
So here's where I think that this is the hardest part of everything. Any call that we go to, you know, people expect that we know what is going on with the individual. We don't know if you are intoxicated. We don't know if you are on drugs. We don't know if you have an injury. We don't know that. So unfortunately, it is not the best thing to do is to have a gun in your hand when we come and encounter with you. We don't know what is going on in your head. And so there again, you know, when people find out later, oh, well, this person may have had this, or this person may have had that. When you're in that situation, these are split second decisions. Yeah. These are not decisions that you get an opportunity to talk to the person and say, hey, what's going on with you? You don't get an opportunity to find out what's going on. A decision has to be made very quick. Okay. Very, very quick. And it would be great to know exactly what's going on with a person. But unfortunately, that's not the case.
Robert Dawkins and Keith Jackson want to chime in on this, Robert.
So it also cuts both ways. When I call a police officer, he's coming to my house with a gun. And I don't know if he's had a bad day, if he just left from another call where he was upset. I don't know what's going on through his head. Mm-hmm. So if you look
but
at you Ruben Galindo, he called. He said, I want to turn in my gun. Right. Ruben Galindo said, I want to turn my gun in. I want to make sure that you know when you come, I'm going to say it 6 times. I have no bullets. He went out on the porch, and even if you listen to the 911 tape in the back, he says, how are you doing, officer? There's nothing else said, and there's shots. These are also, I can't say that every time that I'm going to have an interaction with a police officer, I'm going to have a gun, but I'm going to tell you every interaction that I have a police officer, have an interaction with a police officer, they're going to have a gun.
Okay.
And I think that they need to have as much training and do as much as they can because they're the ones that are protecting and serving. They're the ones that get valor. They're the ones that get honor. They're the ones that get free cup of coffee because you're a police officer. This is what I'm saying. This is they're the ones that people admire and grow up and want to be if we have trust, and they're held to a higher level of accord than average people.
Great.
But never prosecuted.
Great. Greg.
All right, so they have a transparency workshop, and I brung it to my neighborhood. I realized that my people ain't coming to the training facility to sign up for a transparency workshop. So I brung it to my neighborhood, right? And most of my friends are community organizers. We went through the shooting simulation. I'm gonna be real. I shot. It took me like 2 seconds. All of my friends shot. So we all had that type of, why you shooting? Soon as we got the gun in our hand and we said, yo, put the gun down, we were shooting. One of my friends unloaded the gun, the whole gun. So it get different when you go through the simulation. I'm not justifying anything. I'm just telling everybody, go to these workshops.
That is different.
Yeah.
Okay, we can't hear people without a microphone, so let's go over here to where we have one. Go ahead.
Hello, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for this attempt to have another discussion of openness and the attempts at transparency. There are two schools of energies I see. There is an underlying unspoken spirit of racism that pervades our nation, and you can't regulate heart. So that's the disconnect, and I'm very passionate about diversity training and all of those things in regards to the officers and their lawful ability to carry their weapons. I think we stated this in the previous workshop, is that the ability to carry a weapon in America is only justifiable if you're Caucasian. It seems that way. It really seems that way, because when you look at Philando Castile, in his vehicle, you know, his weapon was in his glove compartment. He was fully complicit. And then you have Samuel Du Bois from my home state who had his issues. And it goes on and on and on. And so the 793-plus shootings that were because of a police officer's interaction with a citizen last year, I can't say, and I respect you, and it's so good to see a woman in your position, but I know that it cannot be considered justifiable in every case. Mm-hmm. So there are schools of thoughts. It goes back to this young man and the perceptions of, are you a threat to me, period, economically, physically, right, socially, and the disparities that happen in our breakdowns and unwillingness to be honest in our communication. We all bleed red blood, but absolutely, there is a disconnect of understanding value of lives. And I think, and I know, that if each of us, I have friends of all races and nationalities, and I love it that we can speak very openly. If the fear factor on both sides would be mitigated, and the spirit of love could rise, there could be a tremendous, and I know it sounds utopianistic, but it starts with a decision of the will, and everything that occurs is a decision of the will, including the officers as well as our citizens. I declare and decree by the spirit of God that this is going to change, because I know I'm a part of the change, and we have active persons here. The second challenge I see here in the city, having been here just a few years, is the economic disparity. You all made a statement about millions of dollars being released for people that were employed, but are they $15 an hour jobs?
I'm going to have to stop you there, because we are out of time. I thank you for your passion and for your question and for your comments. This conversation doesn't end tonight. We want to keep the lines of communication open. Please text or call 704-879-3536. We will follow up for additional comments. That number and other ways to connect with WFAE can be found at WFAE.org. And I want to thank all of our panelists tonight for this public conversation edition of Charlotte Talks. Vicki Foster from CMPD, Robert Dawkins from Safe Coalition NC, Greg Jackson with Heal Charlotte, Ash Williams from Charlotte Uprising, Nicholas Wharton with the Urban League, Dr. Patrick Graham of Charlotte Works, Pat Mumford with the City of Charlotte, Brenda Tindall with the Levine Museum of the New South, and our audience here at the McGlohan Theater, who gave us their questions, their opinions, and their time. And we want to thank WUNC for helping us to make this a statewide conversation on the many stations who are part of North Carolina Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Collins. Good night.